I probably won't address the particular topic, but that's what you have. That's what you have, question and answer. I mean, the idea is here that we kind of throw out a few ideas, and then people get to sort of share their own experiences in hearing confessions. The topic that was suggested had to do with classes of penitence and tough cases. And I suppose, because I made sure I was not going to ask Roger or Dave what on earth they had in mind, because you know what they had in mind was probably what I was incapable of delivering. So classes, I imagine what they had in mind was, you know, children, adolescents, adults, men, women, single, married, senile, the whole, you know. I don't want to do that. I'm not going to do that. I don't think I can do that. I think you have to ask questions, because there is the individual is so little defined that you have to have some kind of an idea what are the sorts of things that they should be able to talk about, chores and but I don't want to get too much. I mean, we can. There's a wonderful story, which I've always used when, well, this is 20, 30 years ago, when people were, I suppose they still do, you know, advocating first penance after First Communion, God knows when, you know, maybe long after, so that you have the experience, I'm sure all of you have had it, of people maybe 30, 35 years old coming to you and saying, you know, I've never been to confession before, because it just got lost. I used to recommend people a story by Irish storyteller Frank O'Connor called First Confession. And it's Frank O'Connor was not a, I don't think he was a believer. He was sort of a lapsed Catholic, I suppose. Grew up in Cork and wrote about sort of the Irish experience. And this was the story of a little boy who's being taken by his older sister to make his first confession. And she is a little bit of a shrew, and she keeps telling him on the way to the church, boy, you know, Father Murphy's really going to give it to you. Because you've had it coming to you, and you're going to get it now. So the boy's a little bit nervous. And he finally gets into the confessional, and nobody's prepared him for what he sees, because he doesn't know. He sees it's dark, and he sees that the kneeler is 4 feet above the floor. It's the ledge, of course, the armrest. He says, how on earth is he going to do this? This is a lot tougher than they told him. So he manages to shinny himself up and get so that he is kneeling on the armrest. The priest, in the meantime, is hearing the confession of someone on the other side of the confessional. And then the door, the screen, opens up below his knees. And he's up here, and he doesn't know what to do. He says, this is really impossible. And the priest, looking in, I see these two little feet hanging down. He says, whoa there. Oh, and the little boy is trying to bend himself over so that he can talk to the priest. So his face eventually appears upside down through the screen, and they begin the confession. And so then the boy says, well, is the thing he's worried about, he's been thinking about killing his grandmother. And the priest says, he says, oh, that's a very brave thing to do. How are you planning to do that? And they get into a long conversation of the different means of disposing of his grandmother. And they get into a long conversation, and the boy, well, by this time he's right side up, and he comes out of the confessional triumphant. This priest has understood him. It's been a wonderful experience, much to the chagrin of the older sister, who doesn't think that he's been sufficiently chastised. It's a story about a first confession, which should have been an utterly traumatic experience. If you're talking about traumatic experiences that you don't want to inflict upon seven-year-olds, and I've always, I've said to anyone who thinks, oh, children aren't, you know, they can't be given that, made to go to confession at that age. That you should read Frank O'Connor. He wasn't really a Catholic, but he wrote this story about a first confession, which is a classic. I said I wasn't one to talk about children's confessions, adolescents, men, women. The distinction I want to deal with here first is urban and suburban. For a very practical reason, is that people in an urban setting have it much easier. I mean, they know that there are churches, in, at least in most cities, downtown, where there may even be confessions that are around the clock. I mean, it's something like the Franciscan Church over near Penn Station. Or at least for a few hours in the middle of the day, perhaps more than that. At the cathedral, it's more than that. Suburban, I don't think it's I don't know what those people do. And in other words, they have much less access to the sacrament. And I think a lot of the problems of people who have been away from the sacrament of penance or reconciliation, and who probably should be away from the sacrament of the Eucharist for years, it's because they may not have that. They may not have that ready availability. I'm sure Roger will deal with some of these issues, but I've often thought that maybe there should be a church, one church in every deanery that makes available confession on a daily basis for a few hours, and that duties could be shared by all of the priests that are part of that deanery. I mean, I don't think it would be that difficult to organize. I've raised the subject or the possibility with some bishops in the past, and they kind of looked at me with interest and said, nodded their head, and so I don't know. It's probably a ridiculous idea, but I do think that there's a difference between the sacramental experience of somebody who works in the city, or somebody who comes in regularly, and somebody whose life is they'd have to take a train, or they have to make a big trip to come into the city to do it. because, you know, a lot of people 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon or 4, it's an impossible time for them. The other distinction or classes of penitence I was thinking of was the devout and the clueless. And I seem to have a lot of one and a lot of the other, and I'm, you know, I don't know what's in between there. Maybe there's nothing in between. There's a small percentage of people who are devout, and then there is a huge population of the clueless. Now I think that to hear the confessions of people who come to confession frequently and who might be described as devout, I mean, I think that might be more difficult than the confession of the clueless. Somebody who's come, you know, who's got big, huge problems, or somebody who's been away for 15 or 20 years. I mean, you might instinctively think of as more difficult, rather than the person who comes in with problems that she gets distracted when she says the rosary. Which, of course, many priests would just dismiss out of hand. What are you coming to me with that for? But this is where we need kind of the zeal, the effort to surpass ourselves. What Father Paul last night was talking about, sort of putting bricks into place, and you know, it just takes a little takes mental effort and prayer to find the brick, to know what the brick is. Even if it only is a deepening of a spirit of contrition. I mean, people, devout people, holy people, come to confession frequently because they have great contrition, and because they have this need of confessing their sinfulness to Jesus, and that's what. You know, that's why they're there in the confessional or at that moment. Of course, it's, you know, I mean, it's if you, you know, I remember seeing Jose Maria saying, if you pass somebody on the street who you don't know, and you know, that person just passes by, doesn't acknowledge you, doesn't say hello, doesn't, you know, well, that's. But if it's someone who is part of your immediate family, somebody who is your very close friend, and you pass that person on the street, and there's no greeting, there's no acknowledgement, well, then you know, this is, of course, what happens with a devout person, has that experience maybe of just having ignored, or having, you know, passed Jesus on the street, or just having just not paid attention to him. And this grieves that person, and I mean, the bar is set so much higher in the case of someone who is seriously pursuing the, you know, personal holiness. I think it may be a little bit more difficult. It's all a matter of experience. The temptation is that, or there's something that St. Henry says, he says, you can't be like a wall. You know, I mean, a wall like a handball court, that you bounce the ball up against the wall and the ball bounces back. Someone says, you know, I get distracted saying the rosary. And you say, well, don't get distracted saying the rosary. Or even if it might be something more serious, you know, I masturbate. Well, don't masturbate. Oh, okay. That's the wall. Sometimes we can be just that, just kind of a wall. and we bounce the ball back. In the synod, was that 1986, the one that that led to the post-synodal reconciliatio at penitentia. Well, one of the American prelates present at the synod was Bishop Austin Vaughan, and we were all waiting for what Bishop Vaughan would contribute to the synod, because well, some of us felt that what he had to contribute to the synod might be more interesting, more valuable than what practically anybody else would. He spoke up two or three times, but the last time was he spoke up about devotion, what he called devotion, what would be better referred to as frequent confession. He says, "I would also like to defend the value of routine devotional confessions, which often do not involve any identifiable profound spiritual experience. Often these confessions are brushed aside as useless or worse. There are many times when the sacrament of penance will not be an emotionally uplifting experience, either because the penitent finds it hard to confess at all, or hard to confess even some particular venial sins, or because the penitent is tired or out of sorts or distracted, or because the priest leaves much to be desired in his response, through his own fault or through nobody's fault, or because the penitent wants to get in and out in a hurry," and the priest is kind of a similar mindset, "or because there are long lines waiting, so the process cannot be slow and easy. There are times when both priest and penitent may be glad to get it over with." You've been there. He says, "Even then, every use of the sacrament of penance is an implicit acknowledgement and reaffirmation of basic attitudes in Catholic life. Let me just list 10. He was always famous for listing, let me give you 54 reasons for, and he'd have 54 reasons, and all the bishops in the conference would be kind of sitting there, you know, patiently. "Although there are many more," he says. "One, every time I go to confession, I implicitly acknowledge that I am a sinner, not just a part of a massa damnata, but with sins of my own that were my own fault. Two, every time I go to confession, I affirm implicitly that God's mercy is always available to me, that I can never get so far away that He does not care about me, that no sin is unforgivable, that God is a Father who sent His Son to save me by His suffering and death. This has special significance in an age when many people wonder if God or anyone else really cares about them. Three, every time I implicitly affirm that God's mercy comes through Christ. The most poorly instructed penitent knows that it is the power of Jesus, not just the priest, who is forgiving his sins. Every time I implicitly affirm that God's mercy reaches me through the Church, that she is the mother who loves me in this sacrament, even when I cannot love myself, and that God Himself wants me to come to Him by sharing in the Church's life." That was four. Five, every time I go to confession, I reaffirm that a priest is God's minister in a unique way. 6. Every time I go, I implicitly reaffirm that I can do things with God's grace that I will never succeed in doing on my own. Otherwise, sometimes a purpose of amendment would be meaningless. 7. Every time I implicitly affirm that God wants me to face my sins squarely, say I am sorry for them specifically, and mean it. This means rejecting a part of my past life so that the days ahead can be better than those behind. Every time I implicitly reaffirm that God expects me to do better with and through His grace. Every time I implicitly reaffirm that He wants me to make up for my sins and those of others. Every time a penitent goes to confession, this is number 10, he is implicitly drawn to reception of the Eucharist. What he's saying is that even though it may be this kind of, not really earth-shattering, mind-blowing, huge conversion experience, this kind of maybe weekly or frequent confession, all of these attitudes are being reaffirmed. And it's, he says, in a sense, devotional confession is our need for redemption come alive. We live in a time when things done out of habit are regarded as having less value than those done from careful, conscious choice. And sometimes we do things routinely. We can forget why we started doing them in the first place. But many of our habitual actions contain judgments that are deeply a part of us and that indicate how deeply faith in Jesus has permeated our lives. Frequent recourse to the sacrament of penance preserves my sensitivity to my own sins and to my need for God's help. It also assures someone who is struggling with temptations that God's love and mercy and grace are near. Let me go on to the other part of this topic, which was tough cases. And I don't really know anything about tough cases. I suppose this generally means sort of, different moral conundrums, And my approach to these things when they come, when they don't come that frequently, is that is to punt, or in other words, is I don't want to run with that one. My approach is, if someone comes with a difficult problem involving restitution, or I don't know, when people come, I've had a case where people come and they've in vitro fertilization question, what happens with the leftover embryos, and the first time at least that this issue was presented to me, I said, my God, I have no idea. I don't know what this is. And so, in other words, when I am presented with a difficult kind of a case like that, I would say, well, would you mind if I with all respect and care for your anonymity and so on, if I consult some expert, some moral theologian, someone who knows about these things, someone who's into bioethics, Dave Cavanaugh or something like that, and of course they don't mind. So that's I think that's fairly standard, prudent practice, even if you are pretty convinced of what the answer should be. Now I think let's deal with tougher cases, not because of the complexities of the moral conundrum, but tougher cases because of the dispositions. Dispositions, well, we might think dispositions of the penitent, which might make the confession a little bit difficult. Also dispositions of the priest, which I think is what can also make the confession difficult. I remember the first time I've been doing this at St. Patrick's, just 2 days a week, 2 hours, a couple of hours a day, for the last 5 years. And I would gladly do it more days a week, except if I did that, then if I'm up here in Arnold Hall, then it's, you know, you got to have somebody to replace you, and that gets a little bit more, the more days that you have committed yourself to, the more complicated it becomes to find a substitute. But I remember the first day, there was an old Jesuit who was the other fellow from, not in the cathedral, his name Ed McMahon, who does the same thing as I do. And he said, he's kind of welcomed me. And he said, you know, this is the greatest ministry. And I said, yeah, well, it's great. And But I'm more convinced now than ever that it is the greatest ministry. Well, I mean, of course, it's not the Eucharist, but in the Eucharist, you're not a minister. I mean, you're Jesus Christ himself. It's you're in persona Christi. It's not quite that in the case. You're not in... You're saying, I absolve you. But you're as a minister, in your ministry, there's nothing greater than this. I mean, it's all about this. I mean, you can keep preaching about whatever till the cows come in. I mean, it might be an inspiration. I mean, I'm not saying your preaching is useless, but it. but I knew. I just remember many times I've given. I thought, this is just a wonderful sermon on how, let's say. Almsgiving is a demonstration of faith, and if you have any faith, you're going to give alms. And this is very eloquent, and I'm there, I'm expecting him to come pouring in, not a nickel. or other times that you really think you've hit a home run with preaching about some particular virtue, or even about confession itself. And they're nodding away. But then afterwards, life goes on just as before. But when you have the penitent there, that is really the act of healing. Boy, that is so that I say there's nothing beats it. Now, the reason I say this is because I think it so much depends upon the attitude of the priest. I mean, if he really looks forward to, if you look forward to this as the highlight of your week, these 2 hours that you have a confessional, rather than as a chore, I mean, it'll make a big difference, I think. If you can bring yourself to so that you enjoy. It's not inconceivable. There's a story which I probably no I don't I've got it here, which I sometimes use in dealing with the issue of it's just a scene in a novel by John Cheever. John Cheever was a talented writer who would write mostly about WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, Connecticut, or this part of the world. And this particular scene involves a housewife married to a stockbroker who is, do I have the right thing? who's been just ridiculous. I mean, she's I guess you could call her a desperate housewife. And she's been doing it with the delivery boy from the grocery store. I mean, this is and she really is beginning to wonder about her sanity. Was she crazy? Was she sick? It was the charitable judgment she knew that the street and its people would pass on her. And she rebelled against it bitterly, for if she was sick, well, the world, the village would forgive her sins if she would go to Dr. Herzog, the psychiatrist, whom she had last seen dancing with a fat woman in a red dress. And unburden herself three times a week for a year or two of her memories and confusions. But wasn't it her detestation of bigotry and anesthesia that got her into trouble, her loathing of mental, sexual, and spiritual hygiene? She could not believe that her sorrows might be whitewashed as madness. This was her body. This was her soul. These were her needs. So she makes an appointment with a local minister. His wife, Mrs. Bascom, answered the telephone and kindly invited Melissa to come. Mrs. Bascom, smelling pleasantly of perfume and sherry, led her into the rectory. She would have spent the afternoon playing bridge. It would be sentimental of her, Melissa knew, to long for a life that centered on bridge parties. But the woman's simplicity and good cheer excited in Melissa a dreadful yearning. Mrs. Bascom's containment seemed as substantial as a well-built house, its windows shining with light, while Melissa felt herself to be cruelly exposed to every inclemency. Mrs. Bascom led her into a parlor where the rector was kneeling by an open fireplace, lighting some paper and kindling with a match. "Good afternoon," he said. "Good afternoon, Mrs. Wapshot." That's her name. "I thought we'd have a little fire," he said. "There's nothing quite like a fire, is there, to stimulate conversation. Sit down, do sit down. I have a confession to make." She flinched at the word. "Mrs. Bascom's bridge club, one of her three bridge clubs, met this afternoon, and I decided to give myself a vacation and spent the whole afternoon watching television. Now, I know a lot of people disapprove of television, but during my, shall we say, dissipation this afternoon, I saw some very interesting playlets and some splendid acting, some splendid performances. I wouldn't be at all surprised to discover that the standards of acting on television today are a great deal higher than those we find in the theater. I saw one very interesting playlet about a woman who was tempted, I say, there was nothing at all unsavory, by the monotony of her middle-class life to abandon her family in favor of a business enterprise." And he goes on. Melissa had come to him for compassion, but she felt then that she might have asked for compassion from a barn door or a stone. For a moment, his stupidity, his vulgarity, seemed inviolable. But if he had no compassion for her, wasn't it then her responsibility to extend some compassion to him, to try and understand, to try at least to tolerate the image of a stout and simple man applauding the asininities on television? What touched her as he leaned toward the fire was the antiquity of his devotions. No runner would ever come to his door with the news that the head of the vestry had been martyred by the local police. And had she used the name of Jesus Christ out of its liturgical context, she felt that he would have been terribly embarrassed. He was not to blame. He had not chosen this moment of history. He was not alone and having been overwhelmed at the task of giving the passion of our Lord ardor and reality. He had failed. He seemed, sitting by his fire, to be a failure, as she was, and to deserve, like any other failure, compassion. She felt how passionately he would have liked to avoid her troubles, to discuss the church fair, the World Series, the covered dish supper, the high price of stained glass, the perfidy of communism, the comfortableness of electric blankets, anything, anything but her troubles. I have sinned, Melissa said. I have sinned, and the memory is grievous. The burden is intolerable. How have you sinned? I have committed fornication with a boy. He's not 21. Has this happened often? Many times. And with others? With one other, but I feel that I can't trust myself. He shielded his eyes with his hands, and she saw that he was shocked and disgusted. In matters like this, he said, his eyes still shielded, I work with Dr. Herzog. I can give you his telephone number, or I'll be happy to call him myself and make an appointment. I will not go to Dr. Herzog, Melissa said, weeping. I cannot. And she left the rectory. That's the end of this little vignette, written by, of course, John Cheever, who was not, I don't even know if he was a Christian, but at any rate, anybody, even with, you know, minimally instructed Catholic would say, what Melissa needs is to go to confession. And anybody would say, this is, you know, isn't this a great thing that we have? And that all of these other people, even these very, very, you know, conscientious church-going Protestants, they don't have it. And, you know, it's like Chesterton saying, when people ask him, why did he convert? I want to have my sins forgiven. I just repeat this story so that, not because, you know, so that you will look forward to desperate housewives visiting your confessional, but so that just to sharpen your own kind of sense of the wonder and the greatness of the sacrament of the, you know, of your ministry. Look forward to it as the highlight. If you have those dispositions, a lot of tough cases become quite easy and wonderful. A great deal of healing takes place. Now, I don't know how often people have to deal with long stretches in the confessional. I mean by long stretch, three hours, 2 hours, isn't it? I mean, kind of the long stretch when you begin to wonder, am I ever going to be able to get to the bathroom? I have a kind of a theory about this, which is when I was first ordained in 1960, I was assigned to a downtown church in Madrid, the Basilica of San Miguel, and you had 2 hours of confession in the morning prior to saying Mass at 9:30, and then about 2.5 hours of confession in the evening before and after the evening Mass. And this was a downtown church, there were huge numbers of people. And there would be these peculiar confessionals, the women would go to confession to either side, and then the front was open. I mean, you see these in these are Mediterranean confessionals. The front is open, and sometimes, you know, men might come and confess there in the front, or children, you know. And so I was, you know, I'm sitting there 4 or 5 hours a day. And I'm looking across the church, and the other side, there's an older priest. He really wasn't that old, as when I think about it now. His name was Father Francisco Botella. He was one of the first Opus Dei members, long dead. But he probably was 50, maybe. You know, he's 20 years younger than I am now. But I mean, he seemed... To me, I was, you know, I was 25 years old. I mean, he seemed, anybody, Bernard Berenson said, anybody, old is anybody 15 years older than yourself. You may be 70 years old, but that's not old. 85, well, yeah, that's old. And I think that's a fairly good rule of thumb. So anyway, he seemed like an old guy, and he had these longest lines, and he was there for the longest hours, and he just seemed to be just so, I mean, it was piece of cake. And I, with the long lines and with somebody who going on a little bit too long, I'd get nervous. And I realized that at an early point that nerves are what can be your undoing and make you, you know, 10 times as exhausted as you should be. And you probably need some drug, maybe, or no. You just need to relax. And I noticed, realized that he had a kind of a rhythm, and it was, I got to get that rhythm. Yeah. It sounds like a very mechanical approach to the confessional, but. You want to make sure that your nerves don't cause you to be impatient and as out of sorts, or, you know, liable to react in a So you don't want to ever let yourself get sucked into an argument or debate because you got some. Well, we'll talk about that. This is the dispositions of the penitent, which sometimes can make the particular case hard to deal with. As I mentioned, bad manners, argumentativeness, rebelliousness, don't get sucked into a debate, into an argument. Don't get riled up. You are not the one who has been offended. I mean, it's God who's offended. Now, for me, it's kind of rule of thumb. I try to avoid ever having to refuse someone absolution. Now, granted, there's some cases there's no way around it. But don't be. I find that it's wise not to reach the conclusion that there is, or be careful about reaching the conclusion that there is insufficient contrition. You can always elicit contrition. It might not seem to be very satisfactory, but. Some measure of contrition you can elicit. I mean, you have to remember that they're there, and it probably was a very difficult thing for them to do, or might have been a difficult thing to do. Although, I think in that synod, post-synodal exhortation in 1987, I think it was Pope John Paul mentions the case of, you know, Zacchaeus. They say Zacchaeus, you know, he was just there. Out of curiosity, he just wanted to see what Jesus looked like and could look and see where that particular encounter, how that ended. And so it might be you're not sure just why the person is there, but I mean, I sometimes have made in the past the mistake because of the fact that there are long lines. And this is, you know, this yet another penitent who hasn't been to confession in 20 years or more and doesn't seem to have committed any sins in the past 20 years. And, you know, this is fairly, the longer the longer the time since the last confession, the fewer sins have been committed, except maybe you occasionally use the word of God in vain. So he said, oh no, you're thinking to yourself, oh my, oh. And you, I have these examinations of conscience sort of in the penitence part of the confessional, and so they can use those. I'm not entirely the ones that Paul was mentioning yesterday about the, you know, based on the commandments. And they're good, but they, you know, but they always examination of conscience based on the commandments generally tends to leave out the, you know, stuff from the capital sins like pride or envy, or they don't fit right into the, or you know, sloth doesn't really fit that well. I mean, it's in there. Of course, everything's in there in the Ten Commandments, but it's they tend to get overlooked. So it's, but then again, sort of the you know, an examination of conscience based on the capital sins that would probably might not include things that dealing with worship, which is, you know, the first commandments. And so I don't know. I'm waiting for somebody to come up with a better. But anyway, you have that thing there, and I made the mistake in the past saying, listen, would you mind taking that examination, just go outside, look it over. They never come back. Right. They never come back. And so you got in there, and all right, so it's going to be, you know, it's going to be inconvenient for the people outside, but you don't let that fish off the hook. Oh, it's some. You know, an interesting thing. I don't know what other people's experience, but my experience is that there are far fewer scrupulous penitents today than there were 40, 45 years ago. Now, I'm sure it has something to do with the sense of sin, and just, you know, but. The contraception that's not there coming up to the surface, but you kind of, you know, is there, just like you have a grace estate to be able to pick up things that you know, how did I understand, how did I know, how did I realize that this person was married before? Yeah, I mean, he didn't say. I mean, you've got to trust a little bit your hunches and that might require a question or two. I always keep a stack of these, of Janet Smith's, you know, the contraception, why not, that you ask them to stick it in their DVD player in the car and listen to it, and then listen to it a second time, and then maybe have their wife listen, have the wife listen to it. And sometimes it makes it's a help. Just like it's good to have information about Sexaholics Anonymous or Courage or, you know, the things that you might need, the referrals that you might need to make. Recidivists are just people who keep coming back with the same thing: the pornography, and the internet, and the masturbation, the challenge that I feel with confessions is you got to deal with the, you know, with where the person is. You got to deal with the issue. I mean, not that you're going to get into long discussions about pornography or whatever it is. But the need, I feel, is to get this person to see this larger picture that he has been called to, you know, the life that he has been called to, the discipleship, as Father Ron was talking about, the kind of the you've been called to transcendence. And it is, there's probably a very, very dim awareness. Some might be some awareness, just by the fact that they've come to confession. That's always a challenge because, you know, I'll be just dealing with the one or two with this thing, the pornography or the masturbation, whatever it is, and, you know, talking about the occasions of sin and get the filter for the damn computer and get the, you know, discontinue the cable service for the television or whatever. And then it's over, and I haven't really, you haven't had a chance. Well, most of the time, one of the first things that you say, probably, I mean, I'm probably sure it's all, is that, because we were talking about people coming. I mean, it's 6 months, it's a year, it's whatever. You say, you got to come back 2 weeks from now. Come back, you know, that's the first thing. And most people, they react, I mean, my experience, they're willing to do that. Not all of them do, but you know enough of them that you can notice why they explain why they need it. I think even getting into these things, since men, I mean, like it's these things of lust. Remember this distinction that Dorothy Sayers made about the sins of impurity are sometimes they are caused by unbridled libido, lust. But in this, our century, in our time, you know, 90%, 99% of the sins are committed out of boredom because you don't have anything else better to do. And I mean, whether it's, you know, and it's not that you've got to repress this unbridled sexual appetite. It's more, there's an emptiness. You don't have anything in your heart. There's no noble love there. And so that's why you say, no, it's not just kind of, you know, taking the measures to keep at a distance the temptations that, you know, that everyone faces in this kind of world. But it's that, but it's also, you got to find this greater love. And so, I mean, it's the confession, you want it to. It's not easy because you only have a few minutes, but to get them to see that there is that trend, that vocation, that calling. Let me just end up with a few things. I don't believe in getting cute with penances. Well, because when you have 30 or 40 people going to confession, your interest in being very imaginative about sort of the kind of penance that I just assign some prayers. It's I know some people get very, you know, creative. I think it just creates complications. The confessional I have has got a screen and then a door in the wall, and sometimes I leave the door open because men maybe want to come in. 9 out of 10 people, 19 out of 20 will use the screen. I mean, there's, and I think most priests I know have the same experience. Either one of the more unsuccessful liturgical was the 1972 reform of the sacrament. Nobody that I know, I mean, at least at St. Patrick's, nobody comes in quoting scripture to me. and waiting for my return quote. I mean. I mean, this is people who are We're not talking about. I'm not talking about pre-Vatican II people. I mean, we're just on people who are, you know, just. So I mean, I don't know. You know, about penance services and the like. I'm going on too long. Let's stop there, and it might be something else comes up. But well, 7 minutes is that's pretty good. That's you're dealing with it. Yeah. But I don't fault them. I don't scold them for coming in, let's say, you know, the next day. I mean, that is unusual. I mean, it's not typical. I mean, you can't I don't think you can be telling people, listen, you go to confession as often as you need to. I guess maybe it's a little bit the culture that I come from, where what the founder of the work told us, and I think he says, if anybody ever wants to go to confession, you never say, this afternoon, or I mean they want to go to confession now, you know, he said, wait a minute, no, I'm busy right now, later. You'd never do that. And so I think most of us, I mean, these are the priests of the prelature of Opus Dei, if you go, I'd like to go to confession, he's going to drop everything, anything, I mean, you know, within reason, and we'll hear someone's confession. I mean, it's true, like Paul was saying, sometimes, I mean, you see the lunatic approaching, and you say, you know, well, maybe I gotta get out of here because religion does attract the insane, of course. Not only the insane, but it does. But I didn't answer your question.
No, not yet.
No. I'm aware of that. I mean, I don't know any magic formula.
I think you have to have infinite patience with recidivists, particularly if they're adolescents, and really pray hard for a breakthrough, because it happens. It does happen. So many of these adolescents who are very, not scrupulous conscience, but a very, very good conscience and are in the habit of typically impurity, what have you. And they're driven to go to confession with out of fear a little bit, sort of thing. And part of the fear even drives them to commit more sin. Yep. They need to precisely be given that larger view, that hopeful, optimistic, uplifting advice, that warmth, warm reception, encouragement, moving them forward little by little, and to keep on coming, keep on coming. I would do the opposite. To keep on coming. We'll talk some more. And move them towards conversion. Because it can happen, and it will happen. It might happen 2 or 3 years down the road. It might happen when even outside of your care, but I do think it does occur. I mean, unless, of course, there is a deep psychological issue there, which is another question, obsessive compulsive disorder, or something like that. Even those things can be temporary.
I try to be very interesting. I tell them, look, you're on the 7th, 8th grade. The hormonal hurricane, starts.
Yeah.
And don't be surprised. Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, I wonder about the culpability, you know, of some of these kids.
Well, the other thing is, this raises a whole issue, which is those of us who have grown up in another era. If you think objectively, that those of us who came to maturity, let's say in the mid-50s or early 50s or something like that, or late 40s, the culture that we were subjected to was a culture of incredible propriety. Okay, there was no pornography, none, except underground. It was illegal. There was no abortion. All young women had as their ideal to remain virgins until marriage. They may not have done so, but that was the ideal. It was presented in the general culture. It was in the movies. It was in the music. It was everywhere. It was Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, what have you. And there was a great deal of modesty in dress. more or less, you know, pretty much, even the beaches. So you had, you know, women, men and women didn't live together. You couldn't even rent an apartment without a marriage license at that time, and so forth. You know, you contraceptives, the pill hadn't been invented. We didn't have the sexual revolution. Marijuana was smoked by artists in Greenwich Village, and that was about it, you know, the few people of Hollywood. And young men drank beer, and that was about it. And we didn't all that, and not everyone had lots of money, and we'd have the internet and everything else. So it was, now they are bombarded. The teenager today is bombarded, and men, adult men as well, with a sexual, with an erotic culture which is overpowering. This has tremendous impact. They're surrounded by it. If you've read Bishop Finn's pastoral letter, which has unbelievable statistics in it, very well, carefully documented, it basically makes the point that any child, by the time he or she reaches the age of 12 or something like that, has been exposed to internet pornography or some other form of explicit pornography, something unheard of in another era. This brings about this sort of thing, of an obsession, which then matches, it meets the other thing, which is the hormonal storm and the curiosity, the natural curiosity about the other sex or one's own body, etc., etc. So we're bound to have unbelievable moral issues now that we didn't have before, or at least a number. You know. I don't know if that answers it, but that's my response.
Regarding this recidivist, first of all, I'll note that most sinners are recidivists in one way or another. So we concentrate on certain things, but most of us are either recidivist gossips or recidivist this or that and the other thing. So, secondly, with people coming back with these sins of purity, look to their spirit, because the devil's trap here is to bring them into depression. And so you don't just talk about the frequency of the sin. You talk about how they're feeling, what their spirits are like. You often find out that they're depressed, and that's what you have to pay attention to, whether or not they're getting depressed over this. And so they bring them to understanding that their weakness in this area doesn't make them intrinsically a bad person, etc. So you have to be very, very hopeful for them. Regarding tough cases where you have to send someone away without absolution, which occasionally has to happen, it's very, very helpful to say, well, right, I can't right now give you absolution, but why don't we say an act of contrition together, and then I'll give you a blessing. And they're not sent away as someone who's a pariah, but someone the priest has prayed with, etc.
Expelled.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's good. Very good. Yes. Well, you do try to you make a quick survey of the previous 10 years, right? I mean, even though. And then you tell me, listen, there's probably a lot of things here that you should be telling me that you can't just remember right now. This, you know, and you next time you, because the first thing you say, listen, we don't do this every 10 years, we do this, you know.
I found
so they come.
On that particular thing, also they brought up, because weighing on them so much.
Oh sure, yeah, yeah.
No, I found it.
I think so.
In the hospital work. You get it again and again in people that, you know, may not be around the next day, and you have, you know, maybe see 30 people at night, and you could even in 4 or 5 minutes cover the commandments, and just hit the big thing.
Sure.
And they would just kind of say, yeah, that, and you could. It doesn't take that long.
Yeah.
In the process, you know, you end up being able to encourage them. Well, that if they forget something, and then later on. They remember, well, they'll make it 20 years, make it, you know,
yeah.
But next time you remember, bring anything else. But you're able to cover most of the big things pretty easily.
Well, what about, like, many times when you have children, like adolescents, and they're a little bit ambivalent, but then you detect their parents are not going to church, they're in an invalid marriage, or their parents are sleeping around. There's a whole atmosphere they're going to go back to where it's going to be almost undoing what you're doing in the confessional, and you know, you got a you got an adolescent or young person in there who's not come to mass, who's got a problem with all kinds of different temptations and that. What kind of encouragement can you give to them, knowing that when they go home, there's no.
Well, you're telling me they have to be an apostle.
Yeah.
They have to be a 10-year-old apostle. They have to, you know, they have to feel responsible for bringing their family to salvation, and it, you know, they're quite capable of feeling that responsibility, and they're responding to it. I think, you know, you paint a fairly grim picture. Tough, hard things, family things, financial things. And you make them see that this is all part of a kind of, you know, God's great plan, God's vocation, God's, this is, these tough things are blessings. They are, you know, they're, I mean, try, I don't know, try to, the subject come up before, I mean, try to, it's not a positive, it's not a spin, don't be a spin doctor, but I mean, There's a positive, you know. There's a bonum here.
Maybe
my wisdom. Well, the sinfulness is always the underlying sinfulness is always going to be there, and that is, yeah, it can be cured by God's grace. But I mean, it's, you know, how is